Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to News from the Torah. Today is 17th of January, 2021, the fourth day of the Jewish month of Shvat, and I'm Leah Aroni. This week we'll be reading a very special Torah portion, the Torah portion of Bo. In this Torah portion, Egyptians will experience the last three plagues, locusts, darkness, and the death of the firstborn, and we will witness this experience together with them. The Jewish people will get their first commandment, the commandment to sanctify the new moon and to sanctify time. And we will discuss this new commandment to understand what it means for us today. We will read about the Jewish people receiving the commandment to commemorate Passover that year and for every year going forward. Passover and the Exodus is the central theme of the Torah, and it is a central theme of the Jewish consciousness, so much so that we're commanded in the Torah to remember the Exodus from Egypt every single day of our life. We will also witness as the Jewish people finally leave Egypt and start on their long journey towards the Promised Land. Just think about it. Think about all those Jews finally packing their belongings and leaving one day altogether, leaving Egypt, going into a new reality they could only dream about. For them, it was a whole new experience, a whole new alternate reality they never thought they would live to see. And on this program today, we will discuss some of the alternate realities that are around us. The Biden administration will be sworn in this week, and we will talk about some alternate realities that are awaiting us with the nominations to the Justice Department. And we will talk about the alternate reality that Corona has created for us with a new book by Chaya Peso, Letters from Planet Corona. But before that, we will discuss how time impacts our reality and how Jewish time is so different from Western time. All of that right after the break.
How did a nice Jewish girl from Delaware end up living in Israel? Shalom, I'm Natalie Sapinski. Join me on my show, Returning Home. Meet different people who have moved to Israel. Hear their personal stories, their highs, their lows, and everything in between. Each week, we talk to experts on immigration and the process of moving to Israel. Listen to Returning Home every Thursday, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
And welcome back. So before we talk about the other alternate realities in this week's Parsha, I would like to talk about something that we don't usually think about. Our perception of time. In recent weeks, I've been reading a fascinating book by Professor Eliezer Trachtenberg, in which he discusses the difference between the Jewish perception of time and the Greek, and subsequently Western perception of time. And this book has really changed my thinking about many subjects, and it is specifically relevant today during the Parashat of Bo, where the Jewish people received their first commandment. The very first commandment God decided to give the Jewish people was to sanctify time. God called Moses out, showed him a new moon, and said, when you see a moon like this, you sanctify it as the first day of the month. And since that day, until the destruction of the Second Temple, Jews would sanctify a new moon and proclaim a new month, not by the calendar, but by sight, when two witnesses would arrive to the great Jewish court, the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, and testify that they saw a new moon out. So how does Jewish time differ from Western time? First, we'll need to understand that while the Greek civilization, and by extension, the Western civilization, functions primarily in terms of space, Jewish civilization functions primarily in time. Time is so important to us that the Bible starts with Bereshit, in the beginning, and talks about the creation of matter and also the creation of time. Yes, the fact that time and matter always go together, Einstein's great discovery in the beginning of the 20th century, is prominent in many Jewish writings, going all the way to the Rambam in 12th century. Time, as we just said, is the first mitzvah, the first commandment in the Torah. And the Talmud opens with this discussion about time. When is the appropriate time to recite Kriyat Shema in the evening? So when I say time, what comes to mind for you? You see, in our civilization, following the Greek one, when I say our, I mean the Western civilization, time is just a number. Just like numbers follow one another. 1, 2, 3, 4, at equal distances of 1. We think of time as equal units following one another. 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, or 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. It's just linear time. It's impassionate. It's objective. You can't argue with it. Well, this is not how Jews perceive time. Jews have two ways to measure time. The first is called Sha'a Zmanit. If you think of the time from sunrise to sunset and divide it by 12, each one of those 12 units will be an hour. And obviously, as you understand, the hour in the winter will be shorter than this hour in the summer. But basically, in Jewish thinking, an hour is a packet of sunlight, a packet of energy during the day when people are supposed to act. And how you use that time is a marker of your life. A second way just to think about time is in terms of actions to be performed. For example, there's a time unit in the Talmud, the time it takes to eat a slice of bread, or the time it takes to walk a mile. Now, the reason that the sages of the Talmud used these time measurements was not because they were primitive, but because Jews think about time as energy. Energy meant to perform a certain deed, a certain action. And this is how Jews think about time. The same thing with the previous measurement. If an hour of the sunlight gives you certain life, what are you going to do with it? Jews see time as a gift from God to do his work, to perform his will in the world. I think we discussed this during one of the previous shows. If you turn on your oven for 40 minutes to bake cookies, your oven is turned on for 40 minutes and there are 40 minutes of heat there for a certain purpose, to bake your cookies. So this is how Jews think about time. Now, there are many implications to that. Greek thinking and Western thinking is always future-focused. The past is gone, and we're always looking towards the future. We're always looking to accomplish more, to do more. But here's the thing. We don't know anything about the future. It's completely hidden from us, and therefore Western civilization is control focused. It's doing everything possible today to control the future. Jewish thinking is not so much future focused as it is past focused. As we said earlier, there is a mitzvah in the Torah to remember 10 events that happened in Jewish history every single day of our lives. Why? Because Jews see time as a cycle. The events of Passover didn't happen one time 2,800 years ago and are not celebrated as a historic event. Rather, we see Passover being replayed every single year during the months of Nisan. And the energy of that first Passover comes back every single year. So for Jews, the future is taking the past and recreating it in a new way. The same thing is for every one of our holidays. Every year, the Hag of Shavuot is an opportunity to re-experience the giving of the Torah. The giving of the Torah in Sinai was not a single event in the past. It's a continuous event that happens every single year. So in this way, Jews don't really need to control the future because we have a lot of the markers of the future already built in. We know that in Nisan, we will have the energies of Passover. And then in the month of Sivan, we'll have Shavuot with the energies of the giving of the Torah. Then in the summer, we will have the ninth of Av, the day of the destruction of the temple. And that time has its own energy. During Rosh Hashanah, we will experience the rebirth of the world. And it's a time of tshuva. Hanukkah will be dark, but we're going to reignite it with our lights. And so time is a cycle in which we create new meaning for experiences and energies of the past. If Corona has taught us anything, it's that we are not in control of our time. Just think back a year. We were all running around, all so busy, all standing in traffic because we were all so busy driving around and going places. If I had a dollar for every time somebody said, "I wish there were more hours in the day," I would be a millionaire by today. And then, literally, in a couple of weeks, all of that stopped. And we were locked down. And many of us are still living in places where there are lockdowns and stay-home orders. The stress of the past really reminds me of Pharaoh's decree. Pharaoh's decree to keep Jews enslaved in hard labor to ensure that they're not busy thinking and experiencing and doing God's work. And I think for many years, many of us lived in that workaholic experience of stress where we're constantly busy and constantly trying to control the future. And now Corona is giving us an opportunity to stop that, to think about the present moment, to think about God giving me life for this day, for this moment, to do His work. There's really only one way to merit redemption, the way the Jews merited redemption in Egypt. We need to leave the ways of exile and to embrace the ways of the redemption. And for us as Jews, it really means stepping out of Western thinking or Western tradition and embracing our own. Starting with the very first experience, the very first awareness, the awareness of time that shapes everything we know and everything we think, everything we perceive. So if we are to merit redemption, hopefully very, very soon, we have to embrace this first commandment that the Torah gives us, the commandment to sanctify our time, to maybe set us out our clocks a little bit and start experiencing time, coming outside and seeing the sunrise, coming out and seeing the sunset, experiencing the wonder of the new moon, and coming back to experiencing time, not as minutes on the clock, but as great actions we can do for the glory of God. And it is especially important for us to embrace this Jewish way of thinking about time, to reclaim our own heritage and civilization. As many forces are working today to shape our thinking to fit its own agendas. We're going to talk more about that after the break. Some new ways, some new alternative realities. Stay tuned to hear how some nominations in the Biden administration are likely to shape your thinking and your reality.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I am Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country. From Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
And we are back. So, I don't know about you, but I've been feeling like I'm living in an alternative reality for quite a while. And that alternate reality is George Orwell's 1984. One of my favorite quotes from that book is about power. And Orwell, in his dystopian reality, defines power as tearing human minds to pieces and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. And I feel like this is exactly what's happening around us, and is actually about to get much, much worse. And this brings to mind one of the final Egyptian plagues, the plague of darkness. Darkness wasn't just a lack of light. Our sages ask, where did that darkness come from? It was a qualitative darkness that prevented people from acting, and it also prevented people from seeing each other. So they say that the darkness came from up high, from the godly world. And that makes no sense, because godliness, by definition, is all about light and consciousness and awareness. So how can godliness become darkness? Now, you can understand this if you remember the last time you walked out of your house into bright sunlight. When you walk into a brightly lit day from a relatively dark environment, what happens is that everything around you goes black. And in intense sunlight, we see the environment is black. We basically lose our ability to see. The Rambam, one of the greatest Jewish philosophers and lawmakers, who was also a doctor, writes in one of his books that sick people taste sweet foods as bitter and bitter foods as sweet. They set aside good nourishing food and eat toxic food, and vice versa. And this is a perfect metaphor for the society we're seeing around us. And it's about to get so much worse. Last week, the Biden administration put out its nominees for the Justice Department. And I want to focus on two women that will from now on govern the Justice Department and the American justice system. So one of them is Vanita Gupta. She is a lifelong civil rights attorney, quite an accomplished one. And in a Senate hearing just a few months ago, Gupta told the Senate that everyone is a racist. Every single person is a racist and has biases. So we need to understand the implications of that. If every single person is a racist, it could mean only one of two things. Either racism is normal and we should put up with it, but that's obviously not her meaning. Or the other is that everybody is a racist and therefore you cannot trust yourself and you are bad. And you know what this is called? Gaslighting. Gaslighting is a psychological technique that tells people that they're crazy, they don't understand reality, and that they basically cannot trust themselves. It's a manipulative technique that makes people lose their grounding and makes them ripe for every kind of manipulation. So if you are a racist, every single one of us, and we cannot trust our judgment, then obviously we need somebody else to tell us what the truth is. And who is that someone else? Yes, the party line. The party line will now tell us what the truth is, what justice is, what civil rights are, because we cannot trust ourselves. And if we put up any kind of resistance to this party line, well, very simple. It's just because you're racists. You cannot trust yourself. And this brings me to another Orwellian quote. The greatest heresy is common sense. Because what is common sense about racism? Common sense about racism is that all human beings are made equal. That no matter what your color is, no matter where you came from, no matter your origin, you're all equal and we all have equal human rights. We all have equal value. We all have equal civil rights. Well, if you think that this is what civil rights mean, that we're all equal, that's only for one reason. You're obviously a racist. Because Biden's other nomination, Christine Clark, who is going to serve as an assistant attorney general for, drumroll, civil rights, has other ideas about civil rights. As a student at Harvard and as the president of the Black Students Association, she wrote an article in which she put out a whole string of racial theories that prove how Blacks are superior to others. So check out a few quotes. Please use the following theories and observations to assist you in your search for truth regarding the genetic differences between Blacks and whites. All of these are quotes from her article. 1. Dr. Richard King reveals that at the core of the human brain is the locus coeruleus, which is a structure that is black because it contains large amounts of neuromelanin, which is essential for its operation. 2. Black infants sit, stand, crawl, and walk sooner than whites. 3. Carol Burness notes that human mental processes are controlled by melanin, the same chemical which gives Blacks their superior physical and mental abilities. 4. Some scientists have revealed that most whites are unable to produce melanin because their pineal glands are often calcified or non-functioning. 5. Melanin endows Blacks with greater mental, physical, and spiritual abilities, something which cannot be measured based on Eurocentric standards. End of quotes. Illuminating, right? So after these quotes were brought to light, she tried to walk them back, claiming that the article was a way to put up absurd racial claims as a way of holding up a mirror to other absurd racial claims made against the Black people. Yet, if you have read her article in The Crimson, of course, she makes no mention that these, quote, absurd racial theories should not be taken seriously, and they do look like her assertions. But that's not all. While she served as president of the Black Students Association, Clark invited Professor Tony Martin, the author of an anti-Semitic book, Jewish Onslaught, to lecture her fellow students at Harvard. And while there was considerable outcry about this invitation, she stood on the podium and defended her choice of bringing this person to lecture to Harvard students. And what did Tony Martin have to say? Tony Martin's main assertion is that Judaism holds, quote unquote, a monopoly on racism, and that the sages of the Babylonian Talmud have been the earliest racists in recorded human history. So what we're seeing here in these two examples from Ms. Clark is a philosophy of pitting different races against each other, pitting whites against blacks, with blacks being superior, pitting Jews against blacks, but painting Jews as millennia-old racists. So let's take a step back. One, everybody's a racist. Two, some races are better than others. Three, if you don't understand this, only one reason. You are a racist. And this is about to become the new American Justice Department party line. And if you think about it for a minute, how do you think this is going to inform the Justice Department's choices of whom to prosecute, what policy to put forward, and what legislation to propose? Biden characterized his nomination as American people's lawyers and not as the president's law firm. So this is about to become the party line for the American people. And I cannot see a greater darkness than putting different races at war against each other, putting whites down, putting blacks up, putting blacks down, putting whites up. All of this, in my common sense, is just pure racism. And I really hope that American people can do better. I really hope that America doesn't descend back into its centuries-old pattern of racial riots and racial struggle. Because really, there's no greater darkness than that. And unfortunately, as in Egypt, so today, this darkness is being branded as light. And real light, common sense understanding that all people are equal, is branded as racist darkness. What were the consequences of Egyptian darkness? One, nobody could get up and do anything. And yes, if you are a racist, if you have been brainwashed to believe that you cannot trust yourself, well, this is going to disempower all of us to act and to build and to develop the world, the society, the way we see fit. And two, every person could not see the other. Instead of seeing each other as human beings, as equals, as partners, we're going to more and more see each other as races. And instead of this bringing more harmony, it's going to bring us into a racial war. Folks, we're in for some really frightening, dark times. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back after the commercial break.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa. Each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
Alternate reality, and this time we're joined by Chaya Pessa. Chaya is a sought-after Judaica teacher, and recently she wrote a new book called Letters from Planet Corona. Hello, Chaya. How are you?
Good morning, Leah. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you for being with us here.
It's a pleasure.
So tell us about your book. What made you write it?
Okay, well, I never set out to write a book. That's one of the first things I write in the book. I basically began to write this the week after Purim, which was 10 months ago. when I looked out my Yerushalayim home and said, what on earth is going on here? There was already no people on the streets. There was no traffic. Schools had closed. Business had closed. And we knew that this was a worldwide phenomenon. And I really felt that I had left the world that I was familiar with, and I was in some sort of strange new place. And I thought of it as being Planet Corona. And basically, sort of to help put my thoughts out there, just for my own self-preservation, actually, I wrote something called A Letter from Planet Corona and sent it to a few friends and family on email. And that's how it got started.
Okay. You told me in our conversation earlier that you see parallels between Corona and the plagues of Egypt. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Okay. So first of all, the obvious similarity is the fact that a lot of people are certainly thinking of this pandemic as being a time of plague. We are plagued by a microbe that we couldn't even see, but it's clearly wreaking havoc on the world. And that's certainly similar to what was done in Egypt so many in millennia ago, when Egypt was almost essentially destroyed by the plagues that Hashem sent there. And the important thing, the important element there, and I think it was an important element in my book, which I stress frequently, because ultimately my book ended up being 70 letters that I wrote for 7 months between right after Purim until after Sukkot. And a lot of it had to do with how are we supposed to understand what's going on, and my own thoughts about this planet Corona. The Rambam, Maimonides, says that if a calamity befalls a community, they have an obligation to learn something from it, to reflect on their actions. And he says that any time that happens and the community does not do so, they are considered a community that are achzari, cruel. In other words, it's a sign from Hashem to reflect. It's a sign from Hashem to learn something from it. In fact, one of the things that I say in my book is that so many billions and actually trillions of dollars have been lost in this year, that wouldn't it be a terrible waste of such a huge sum of money if we don't learn something from it?
So what should we learn, Chaya, in your outlook? What is the lesson? What's the takeaway?
Okay, so I don't have, thank God, enough hubris to say that I know the answer. God doesn't speak to me directly and say, this is what I want you to tell people. But the fact that we're supposed to learn something, for instance, in Egypt, it's very, very clear. The commentaries speak about it and say that what the Egyptians needed to learn, and the Jews, was who is this God? Because the Egyptians, the first reaction that Paro has when Moshe comes to him and says, God has sent me to you to say, let my people go, Paro essentially looks through his list of gods and says, who is this God? I don't know him. He's not on my list. He's not one of the gods that I'm familiar with. Because the gods that he was familiar with were a different kind of a God that had to be placated or bribed. This was a God that was all powerful, and he did not know what that was about. And God essentially says, you don't know who I am? Well, I'm about to show you.
This is so interesting, because I think very often, you know, even in today's society, when people think about God, they think of somebody who needs to be bribed by our actions or placated, this vengeful, angry God that if we don't get on his good side, is going to go after us. And I think a lot of people are seeing Corona as this God's vengeance against us for all of our sin. And I don't think that this is a helpful or wholesome or an empowering way to consider God. What are your thoughts?
Oh, I don't think so at all. In fact, in the class that I had on the Parsha about the plagues, it seems that in each of the set of plagues, you probably know from the Pesach Seder that we divide the plagues into three groupings, Tetzach, Adash, Ba'achav. We say that at the Seder, the three afterwards, and then the four at the end. And that each grouping, The first two were signs, and only the third one was a punishment. And the signs are to teach us things, just like a parent may do something to a child that the child sees as a punishment. But the parent knows what they're doing is teaching the child a lesson. The child is too immature to understand that. So there's a difference between a punishment and a lesson. There's a difference between a wake-up call and being clobbered. And even though it felt to the Egyptians like they were being destroyed, it was only because they were not understanding and taking the lesson. After each one of the plagues, they were being given an opportunity to acknowledge that this was a God who was, in fact, in charge of the world, and not a God that simply needed to be bribed, which is a much lesser idea. And I think we need to learn the same thing. But what the lesson is may be different for different people, may be different for different communities. I don't know if you remember, but in the beginning, a lot of people who were along this track were saying, oh, it's because we've abused the environment, or, oh, it's because we don't have positive racial relations. Everybody, or we don't give women enough honor. Everybody decided that they knew why this was happening. And the fact is we don't know, but we can look in ourselves individually and the community and say, where am I not doing things properly? Where am I not fulfilling what is really good and right? Whatever, by whatever standards are the standards that I have. And there, to make improvement. And each person needs to know what they need to improve.
So can I be really forward and ask you what your takeaways have been?
Okay, first of all, I learned a few things from it and I write about them in the book. We are the richest civilization that's ever been, really. We have everything today, especially if you think about the people that we know. There certainly is starvation in the world, but not the way that there once was, and certainly not in our environment. And we have homes and we live pretty well. And I think we're abusing that. That's certainly one of the takeaways. We're far too materialistic. We have lost our understanding of what we need and what we want. And often of those things that we want or would like, we say, I need to have it. Think of a teenage daughter saying, but I need another pair of earrings, even if she's got 20 pairs. And that's only a small level, the kinds of weddings we make, a lot of the things. That's certainly one takeaway, but I'm trying to avoid takeaways that are for other people, because I think it's always too easy to do. We often think about what other people are doing wrong and really what we're doing ourselves. Somebody once said that when on Yom Kippur, when we hit our chests about the sins that we've done, we should be careful that we're hitting our own chests and not the chest of the person standing next to us. We need to know that these are personal improvements that we need to make. So yes, one of them is materialism. One of the things was that I'm very about how fortunate I am. I think one of the things that a lot of us can take from it is that now that certain things have been eliminated from our lives, I haven't been able to hug a grandchild for 10 months. I miss it terribly. And I'm learning how valuable something like that is. And even though I don't think I took it for granted ever before, it's something very special today. And hopefully I'm looking forward to it. I've already had one vaccine. I'm hoping to have my second. One of the first things I'm going to do is going to show the people whom I love how much I love them in a physical way, which I haven't been able to do. And that's something that maybe was undervalued. And now we know just how important and how valuable these things are.
That's a very interesting perspective. It's very true. So on the one hand, we have a lot of improvement to do in changing how we do things. But on the other hand, a great takeaway is appreciating what we do have and seeing the value of it. We are one of the richest societies. So we're very, very blessed. And yet when we wake up in the morning, our first thought is, you know, what's wrong with my life? I don't have this thing, or this person doesn't do things the way I want. I think we're so in control. And I think one of the messages that we all have, and obviously it's different for every one of us, is we really have zero control. And God is sort of reminding us through this little, tiny virus, how little control we really have in our life.
That's certainly one. Yes, I'm sorry. I'm just saying that's one of the messages also that I say in the book about how little control we have. We had so much hubris. We thought that science knew everything. In fact, it's interesting that at the end of the 19th century, a very famous physicist said, there is nothing new to be discovered. Everything has been done. And then there was this explosion of scientific discovery in the beginning of the 20th century and then going on.
Yes, that's a very powerful message, Chaya. So it was a pleasure talking to you and hearing your thoughts. Letters from Planet Corona. I've read some of the letters and they're fascinating. It's a terrific book. Thank you so much for writing it. And thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Have a great day.
You too.
And thank you for joining us today. Until next week. Bye-bye.
Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. Just click the orange button at the top of the IsraelNewsTalkRadio.home page, log in as yourself or an anonymous guest, and join in on the fun. You'll meet other listeners from all over the world who listen to Israel News Talk Radio, and you can make new friends. Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. It's the closest you can get to being in the studio with us.
We love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.